Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's hard to believe, but people are still falling for those Nigerian internet scams. You know, the one where you get an email from a supposed business person or government official who needs your help to get thousands of dollars out of the country. One of the most lucrative swindles on record just made news. A nurse in Oregon was taken for $400,000 over a period of 2 years. Why do people fall for stuff like this? Turns out, human brain chemistry makes us vulnerable, thanks to a chemical that makes us inclined to trust others. That's the finding of Dr. Paul Zak. He's the director of the Center for Neuroeconomics Studies at Claremont Graduate University. He's here now to explain his research. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, and hello from Rotterdam, the Netherlands.
Thank you for calling us there. We'd like to open this up to your calls. If you, meaning listeners, have ever been scammed, call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe you conned somebody. Give us a call or call us on our website or check in on our website, WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. Now, Paul Zak, you were the victim of a classic pigeon drop scam as a teenager. Tell us about that.
I worked at a gas station, and lo and behold, a man comes in and found a pearl necklace in the bathroom, and I get a phone call of someone who lost it and wanted to offer a reward to get it back, but the man who found it couldn't stay. And so it occurred to me, it was such a nice necklace, that, boy, if I just put the reward to this man, kept the necklace, then we could both be better off, and this necklace would go to the man's lovely wife who was expecting it as a gift. So there's two interesting things that happen in the brain there. One is, of course, there's greed motivation, but it turns out that's actually not as important as the helping motivation. As you mentioned, my lab discovered a couple years ago that this ancient hormone in our brains called oxytocin causes us to want to reciprocate. It makes us want to cooperate with people, including complete strangers. So that's how the pigeon drop works. You have this confederate who is just trying to be a nice guy, just trying to help out another fellow human being, and then sucks you into doing that. Hey, let's help these people out. Let's get this nice pearl necklace back to this guy. Yeah, we can split the reward. That's great. So the greed aspect just kind of pushes you over the edge.
Is oxytocin related to those sort of, maternal chemistry that cause you to relate to a child in a specific way?
Exactly right. So it's released during childbirth and during breastfeeding. What we found is that when a complete stranger trusts you with your money, with his or her money, that your brain releases the stuff and it motivates you to want to reciprocate or cooperate with him or her. And we found that about 2% of our so-called normal college student subjects don't actually have this response. They're sociopaths, and if you trust them with their money, they will abscond. They'll go away. They are con men or con women in training.
So it's sort of something akin to willingness to go through extreme pain for sort of an altruistic outcome. Is that right?
Isn't that interesting? And so the key on a con is not that the person being conned trusts the con man. It's the opposite. The con man shows that he trusts you. And because we're reciprocal creatures, the con man who feigns fragility, he needs help. He sucks you into this story. I really need you to help me. And that's what gets us going. It activates these ancient emotional mechanisms in our brain that are associated with care for offspring, love for our spouses, and sometimes get hijacked to empty our wallets.
So there's this, when you say, how could anybody be so foolish? In fact, our brains are sort of, playing a trick on us.
It is, but it's a wonderful trick. So we've also found that the majority of economic transactions involve trust, and this hormone essentially establishes those relationships, so you don't need a government entity watching your every transaction. It motivates generosity, giving to charity. We've done a large number of studies showing the variety of situations in which oxytocin motivates help for a stranger. So it's only this small number, this 2% of the population, who have figured out who have a real brain dysfunction, by the way. We can identify them before we even test them behaviorally. They have a dysfunction in the oxytocin system. They've learned how to simulate trustworthiness. They come to you and they need your help, and they draw on our normal, appropriate, and even beautiful emotions, right? We help strangers out. There are almost no other animals on the earth, except for maybe the apes, that really help out unrelated members of their species. So human beings do a lot of that. We give money to charity. We help strangers in the street who trip and fall. And occasionally, we're also prey to con men.
All right, so let's take a call now, 212-433-9692. Maybe you've been scammed. Did you look back at it and think, how could I have done that? Una from Manhattan. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hello. I was conned, and it was a very bad thing, and I'm actually calling in to warn other women or perhaps men that there is a con that I don't know. I'd never ever heard of it. I met someone who told me they loved me. I believe them. They were from another country. We got married, and the minute the ring was on my finger, party over. What they wanted was the green card. And it was such a torturous realization, first of all. But second of all, getting out of it is horrific. So I would just say to anyone who may be involved, it was someone from another country, just take it easy and wait at least a year or possibly two before you marry them.
How long did you wait?
Not long enough, obviously.
How long?
Maybe 6 months.
6 months. Well, that's not so short
enough.
Either. Paul Zak, director of the Center for Neuroeconomics Studies at Claremont Graduate University, that's something that, you know, sort of went on over 6 months. It involved love. It involved courtship. Is that the same principle operating here?
Absolutely. That's oxytocin, which is really the physiologic signature for love and for empathy, for caring. So this gentleman, you know, used Una's innate brain mechanisms for his own purposes. And it's extraordinarily cruel because it's these brain mechanisms that really bring out the best in human beings. It makes us care for others, love for others. It connects us to the rest of humanity. But again, there's that small proportion of the population who have somehow, they don't have the same wiring we do. And they've learned how to take advantage of this system.
So
I think Una's right. You have to sort of check your emotions and be a little careful.
But if we're talking about brain chemicals getting turned on and turned off, I mean, how is that something that we can consciously control?
Okay, so this mechanism makes it rewarding. It makes it almost rewarding like drugs of addiction are rewarding, like cocaine or methamphetamine. It modulates this reward mechanism in our brain to motivate us to care, attach to other people. Having said that, that reward system is therefore modulated, or further down the line, modulated by our newer evolved prefrontal cortex, this new part of the human brain that lets us plan things, called the executive center for your brain. So as Una said, you really have to just slow things down. The emotional centers work quickly, they work not very precisely, and they motivate behavior quite strongly. Love is as motivating as is fear. And yet this newer evolved area of the brain kind of weighs all those options and settles things down. So following rules, taking your time, waiting periods. For example, there's a federal law on when you purchase a handgun, you have to wait three days before you can pick it up. That's exactly to slow down your decision. So if you're buying that with some nefarious reason in mind, you maybe will think better of it.
Now, in your work, you've also looked more broadly at the links between trust and how a society's economy functions. So how do you square the current economic breakdown with the idea that markets are also driven not by greed, but by the idea to do something positive?
That's right. So my current book is called Moral Markets, and we found in that book that in fact, it's moral behaviors that drive the economy precisely because you can't scrutinize every transaction. Even though you have enforcement mechanisms, there are lawyers, there are courts, for the most part, you have to sort of shake hands and do a deal. So it requires that most people, most of the time, are in fact moral. Having said that, there are certainly financial incentives to cheat the system, to cheat other people. And we're seeing the backlash of that in the breakdown of financial markets. So the reaction in the human brain when you see these highly volatile, risky markets is to avoid that system. So risk in the human brain is encoded as pain, which is very interesting. So the brain reuses these systems that evolved for one purpose for multiple purposes. So I think what we're seeing now is this desire to flee to safety, to get away from pain. If that costs $700 billion or $1 trillion, in some sense we don't care because we want the current pain to end. So it's just like we are chronic pain patients. We are just chronically watching the news, feeling this pain, we want to get away from it, and pain inhibits the trust response. So when you're fearful, you're not trusting and you don't undertake the transactions.
So yesterday there was another one of those days where people were watching the Dow and there was that incredible sort of, you know, feeling of being in a dream and you're in free fall and you can't stop it. It's up a little bit today, 85 points as of a few minutes ago, 1% change from yesterday. But how does all of these sort of, you know, brain chemistry fit into the Dow watching? And is there any way that it could be used to stabilize things?
Well, we certainly are prone to overreaction in financial markets, both on the upside and the downside. So when you have bubbles, you get kind of euphoric and you strongly activate these reward systems, which makes you want to keep doing what you're doing. Again, just like a drug user or enjoying a wonderful meal, you don't want to stop because it feels so good. And on the downside, you have the same problem. We're in this fear-pain mode, and so people are now operating in a fearful get-away-from-it state. So the only way to change that is actually to change the market psychology. I hope with the election of President Obama, there'll be a change in the sort of feeling in the nation. If we get some positive economic news, that would be good.
Wasn't that supposed to have happened already, that Obama was elected and people were supposed to start feeling better immediately?
I don't know. Apparently not. I think we have to wait and see. But I think, I don't want to prescribe Prozac or oxytocin in the water supply. Not a good idea. We certainly want to be conditional trusters. But I think people don't feel like they're ready to trust financial markets, financial investment advisors. Having said that, the worst thing that you can do is pull out when the market is down. As long as you have a 5-year or longer time horizon, then stocks will rebound. And 3 years from now, we'll just be looking back saying, wow, we overreacted.
That might be the most reassuring thing our listeners have heard all week. I'm Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. I'm speaking with Paul Zak. He's the director of the Center for Neuroeconomics Studies at Claremont Graduate University. Let's go to Len from Brooklyn. Hi, Len. You're on WNYC. Tell us your story.
I was up by Zabar's, and I was waiting out in the car for my wife who was shopping, and a car drove alongside me, and there were two guys in it, and they said, you got a minute to talk? And I said, yeah, sure. He said, look, he said, I'll come right out. He said, I'm a thief. I said, okay. He said, and I stole some stuff, and I want to sell it. I said, what are you trying to sell? And he takes out something from his pocket, and he unwraps it, and it looks like it's a gold bar. I said, yeah, right, it's gold. He said, I've got 4 of them, and I'll give it to you for a tenth of the price. And that was like $4,000, and I really needed money at that point. I was really tapped, and I had enough to cover it. But I didn't want to do it, just give them, let me get the money and here, let me take the gold. So I said, well, let's go down to Chinatown. We went down to Chinatown, and there was a company there called Ross Refining. And we took his car, and I'd parked mine.
Wait, but what happened to your wife who was shopping?
I left the car for her. I parked the car.
I see.
And I went with these guys down to Chinatown, and he told people a drill out. He pulled a little handheld drill. And he took one of the bars out, and he drilled a hole into the bar. He took out some shavings, and then he gave me the envelope, and I went upstairs to the refining place, and they took what was in the envelope out, and they checked it. And he came back. He said, it's 14 karat gold. He said, buy everything they've got. So I went downstairs, and I bought all 4 bars, and I gave him $4,000. And I put those gold bars aside for a day when I really needed the money, when I was really tapped. And the time came a few years later. And I went to sell them, and I was told they were brass. I said, how could it possibly be? I saw him drill a hole. I saw him put it in the envelope. He gave me the envelope. I went upstairs, and it turns out what he did is he swapped envelopes.
Oh.
He had 14 karat gold shavings in one envelope, and like a dummy, I
All right. Let's get a response from Paul Zak. Tell us what happened here. What was going on in Len's brain while this was all happening?
Hi, Len. That's a version of the classic pigeon drop con. And again, he was trying to help you out. You were trying to help him out. You know, he made you trust him because he revealed this potentially valuable information to you that he was a thief. You could have turned him in. So right away, now you're playing ball in his court. Right? He revealed this information. He showed what a good guy he was. I'm a thief, but I want to play fair with you because we can both win from this. And then you switch the envelopes. And the money's gone from your pocket. So, again, the greed part's important. It was trying to get you in the idea of this con to make money. but also was the helping part. So the key part of your story, which was fascinating, was that he told me he was a thief. So if it sounds too good to be true, unfortunately it is.
Just quickly,
I'm sorry,
Len,
to hear your story.
Just quickly, Len, I mean, did you think, like, at any point during this process, like, this is $4,000 from somebody I just met?
Nope.
No.
Because once they told me upstairs at Ross Refining that it was 14 karat, I said, oh, my God, I got some cash finally.
So you thought you'd, instead of stumbling on some misfortune, that you'd stumbled on just a huge big break and that you had to grab it at that moment.
And I still have the bars. I still have the bars to remind me that everything, what's that old phrase, everything that glitters is not gold? It wasn't, but now I stack them on my desk, and I look at them, and it reminds me regularly how not to be taken if you can possibly avoid it. But I'll get taken again. You get taken all your life. Something happens, and you go weak, and you
all
just...
All right, then. I hope you're in a better economic situation now that you're
Thank God. I mean, you know, now I'd give them $4,000 just to teach me the trick.
All right. Thank you very much, Len. You get the last word. Thank you very much to Dr. Paul Zak, the director of the Center for Neuroeconomics Studies at Claremont Graduate University. Thanks so much for joining us today. Thanks to everyone who called. Don't forget, the conversation continues online, WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. He'll be back on Monday.